Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And yeah, Fred was just going to throw a couple of questions my way about a fault tree analysis course workbook.
Well, you sent me, you know, I'm not an editor, right? I just open up Grammarly and go through it and look for spelling errors that I can't possibly help you find. So, it's a cool looking workbook. It's a nice text, actually. And you're a graphic artist and I guess you're the graphic artist and stuff that's impressive. But one of the things that struck me in it, and it's something like, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't think of it that way. It was kind of right at the start, is you talk about there's like three approaches or philosophies or uses. I don't know what the right term is. A fault tree. And now I was raised and brought up on that you use a fault tree analysis to really get at the multiple paths to create the unwanted event, or if you flip it over and call it a success tree, what are the multiple paths that all have to work for it to get the successful event? And it's a way to think through, especially for critical failures with high consequences. And I see it more often like in medical devices where they want to make sure that they have they don't have single point failures that are likely to occur, or they have safeguards, or they have, you know, bounding boxes on stuff in order to interrupt the path towards some unwanted event. I've often used it that way as feedback to organize thinking in the design process. And I've heard of, and I've run across people that will pull out a piece of paper and do a fault tree when they're doing failure analysis. This kind of think through, we see this symptom and it caused this problem. This failure mode occurred, and we believe there's multiple ways it can happen. And fault tree is kind of a nice way to organize that thinking. But I always said, well, you should have done this during design and you could have prevented it. But that's just me. And then there was a third one that I was like, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, and I must admit that the reason I did this course is because I sort of keep getting asked about it. And when I do my courses in general, I touch on fault trees, as you tend to do in reliability engineering courses. And then a lot of people actually ask specifically about fault trees and they go, I didn't know you could do that with them. And so that's the impetus for this course, where it's just a fault tree analysis short course, where it is a short course, but it's also a deep dive into it. And again, I like focusing on the stuff you need to know and not the let's call it the infinite variations and interpretations you could make if you really wanted to develop a theoretical textbook as opposed to something that's going to help people. But
well, what was the third one? I'm drawing a blank, but it was unique, and I have to go back and look at it some more. But I want to hear, you know, what is it? What are the three methods here? How do you separate them?
Well, I call them perspectives. So the first perspective was where you're trying to analyze system reliability.
That's why I couldn't think of the word. It's one of those PhD words.
Oh, my goodness. Just because it starts with P.
No. It had four syllables in it, or three or something like that. It's just too big for me. No, okay, anyway, give you a hard time here. Right. So perspective, that makes sense, yeah.
The first perspective is when you're trying to model and analyze system reliability. So you're trying to measure system reliability characteristics. So the premise for that scenario is that you understand, or at least can estimate, component reliability characteristics, and you need to combine those together to spit out a system reliability characteristic.
Why wouldn't you just use a block diagram?
You could use a block diagram, and I certainly don't want to advocate a fault tree as the only tool for doing system reliability modeling. But if we just to look at how fault trees can be used, if you choose to use a fault tree, then a fault tree is, in that context, can be just as powerful as a reliability block diagram.
Well, is this my thinking of when to use a fault tree is that in a block diagram, you can organize it by subsystem or components, or you can organize it by failure mechanisms, and there's lots of flexibility in that. Mm-hmm. But generally, it assumes that each box is independent. Each event is independent. And you can set up, like if this and this both fail, then this fails, and then that triggers this next sequence. So you can set up a block diagram like a fault tree. But what I find is the fault trees shine when you have a single top event that you really want to focus on and have multiple paths and interrupts to those paths to get there. It facilitates going deeper into the logic of your system.
That's right. And so a fault tree is a visualization methodology at its heart. And the thing you're talking about, the top event, is that oval shape that sits at the very top of a fault tree, which is the undesirable event that you're fascinated in. So if you're obviously if you're trying to understand failure, then the top event could be a certain type of failure, if you're maybe a particular failure mode, or perhaps it's like explodes violently, whatever it is.
Or it makes cold coffee when you're not looking for cold coffee. That would be bad.
Now for you, that'd be worse than explodes violently. I know that, but yeah. So when you're interested in understanding or measuring the frequency of failure or the nature of failure at the system level, fault trees and reliability block diagrams are useful tools for doing that. And fault trees, the other good thing about reliability block diagrams is they can mimic the physical layout of a system in many cases. So you actually have blocks which might look like how they interact with each other, especially if they're along a pipeline, for example. You can have a pump, a compressor, a valve, and a holding tank. And when you have a reliability block diagram, it might look exactly like that in a physical sense on the ground.
Right.
Fault trees don't do that, but what they do is use logic gates, which tends to align with the human thought process. And again, in the course, in the workbook, we go through the pros and cons of a fault tree, which might lead you to use a fault tree in one circumstance or a reliability block diagram in another.
Okay. But that's one perspective is for design modeling or system modeling, where you want to measure it. Okay.
And the second perspective, so first perspective is measuring reliability, especially at the system level. The second perspective is root cause analysis. And you see a lot of fault trees used in root cause analysis. You see a lot of fault trees used in sometimes in familiars as well, where you have, a bad event, an undesirable event. That's a top event still. But instead of trying to model system reliability, you're actually trying to find the root causes of that bad event to try and inform or make your design better or remove that root cause from existence to prevent that failure from ever occurring. And we use an example where NASA actually used a fault tree to conduct root cause analysis for the Columbia space shuttle when it failed on re-entry in 2003. And one of the structural differences between a system reliability model fault tree and a root cause analysis fault tree is a system reliability model, the basic events, the things that make up the building blocks of the fault tree, they are typically events or component failure events, whereas for a root cause analysis, those building blocks are root causes. And the idea is you want to analyze and do what we call deductive top-down reasoning to identify those root causes, so you can then design them out of your system or remove that environmental stress so that failure never happens again.
But this is, I've often seen it used as a way to organize a brainstorm, essentially, different than doing a Ishikawa diagram or a fishbone diagram is a way to generate lots of ideas. But I've seen it where the team will say, all right, we had this problem or we need to make this improvement and we'll do a fishbone diagram first. And then let's organize that in a logical sense. And then they turn to the fault tree to then say, all right, here's how these things interact and then what's the most likely one. I've also seen it when fault and failure analysis is that exercise generally doesn't resolve it. It just says, all right, we've got these three likely paths or base events or root cause potentials. Let's go do some experiments and figure out which one it really is in this case.
Right. And actually, I'm glad you touched on that, because when you're creating a system reliability model, you tend to not have to do a ton of brainstorming, because the system is what it is. There's a pump, there's a holding tank, there's a valve, there's a pipe, there's a switch,
You obviously haven't worked with chemical engineers then.
I take your point, but it's feasible for a single reliability engineer to look at, or any engineer to look at nuclear power plants and say, okay, so that pump feeds into this and it goes through that turbine and that condenser. And then the fault, if you're competent, you can create a fault tree which models system reliability. But when it comes to root cause analysis, I love the term you use, brainstorming. Brainstorming is at the heart of root cause analysis. And a fault tree in root cause analysis is supposed to give structure to that brainstorming activity. And the fishbone diagram is actually, from my perspective, not a million miles removed from a fault tree. It's actually pretty similar. You got a single bad event and you got lines drawn, you know, emanating from that bad event and branching off into ever increasingly specific causes until you get to a certain level and you go, aha, that's a potential root cause. You actually talked about a scenario where you could use a fishbone diagram or a fault tree to come up with a set of potential root causes, which you then might go and investigate. But in many cases, what we can hope to achieve in root cause analysis is come up with a bunch of likely root causes. You say, all right, there, whatever caused this failure was one of these 10 or a combination of these 10. So you go on, as opposed to conducting a further investigation.
Well, what I think it does is it gives you a structure then to avoid the random guesses. You know, you got 3-4 people and each have their own theory. Well, let's put our heads together and suss out what is the likely ones. And we might end up with 10 of them. But all right, now what can we do to replicate that problem, you know, from these particular causes, and does it manifest in the way we expect it to? Right. Is it to give us all of the symptoms and explain everything? Can we turn it on and off? And you might end up with, you know, one of them of the 10 is actually what you saw, this particular failure that you saw in a prototype or in the field. But the other 9 that you came up with might be other opportunities to make improvements. And so it's
exactly,
it may be worth investigating anyway. So different than trying to estimate system reliability as a model, this one is trying to sort out, organize your thinking around, well, what could have caused this problem?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the key difference between perspective one, where you're modeling system reliability, you have component reliability characteristics. That's typically all about measuring reliability. But from perspective number two, when you're conducting root cause analysis, it's more brainstormy. It involves a team. You're trying to improve reliability, and it's collecting that impressive combined corporate knowledge from your team to do that.
Right. So what's the third perspective?
A third one's my favorite, actually, and it doesn't get a lot of airtime. So the third perspective, number one, modeling system reliability or analyzing system reliability. Perspective number two is root cause analysis to identify what caused the atrocity. But perspective number three is, you know, what I call robust customer-centric design. And that is where we use an approach similar to the root cause analysis approach, where we are doing brainstorming, we have a top event, but we're doing that before we observe the failure, which is my favorite time to eliminate failures, before they actually occur. And so that's where I talked about FAMEA is activities where you are trying to make your first design a reliable design. And so you identify likely dominant failure modes and they become your top event. And then you can create a fault tree if you want to. There's different techniques to identify potential causes for that potential failure mode. And you just eliminate those causes out of your system. So your first design becomes a reliable design. But even better than that, we can change what failure is defined to be. So instead of failure simply being a mechanical interpretation of failure where your thing disintegrates or rusts or explodes.
Where the green light doesn't come on.
Right. But failure, if we just change a perspective of failure to failing to meet our customers' expectations, then it becomes an incredibly powerful tool to work out what characteristics we need to prioritize in our design to make it firstly robust so it won't fail, and secondly be just awesome and make our customers want to purchase ours as opposed to a competitors. It's really powerful.
Does this overlap the way you're describing that? It sounds like it overlaps with the House of Quality, which I've never ever seen anybody ever use. I've seen lots of training on it, but I've never seen any. I think the idea is that you connect the nebulous customers' expectations and wants to your technical design parameters, and then you relate those design parameters to what the customer wants. Here it's, what does the customer expect, which is going to be fuzzy and squishy depending on how well you know your customers. But then you're using the fault tree to say, well, how can we, what affects that criteria? How do we deal with that? How do we have features that make that work? And I think you used an example in your FMEA webinar the other day where it's, was the push the talk button.
Correct.
It was make it gnarled so you can feel it and you know where the button is, and it has little edges that guide your thumb to find it even when you can't see it and stuff like that. And those were expectations for ease of use that would have never been in a product requirements document without having thought through, well, how is this going to be used? What's the expectation?
Right. We actually do use that example in the course itself. The example you're talking about is the Motorola two-way radio. And the issue was that Motorola was making fantastic two-way radios, always have, and continue to be an industry leader. But what they did was they said, you know what, we want to make sure we keep pushing the limits and retain our position as a leader in the industry. And so they started looking at how they could fail to meet the expectations of their customer, not just the device failing, but one example was the military, who use these two-way radios a lot. But military operators have these really thick gloves, which can make it difficult to push the push-to-talk button on our two-way radio, or perhaps even worse, inadvertently push the button without knowing it, which jams the entire network. And so they conducted a FMEA and did use root cause analysis techniques, which in some cases would have included a fault tree, to work out what they needed to do to incorporate into their design up front to not fail from the perspective of the customer. When they did, I mean, it's in the workbook, they came up with some really simple corrective actions or ideas that were designed into the radio, which are really clever, almost free, because this is talking about changing the shape and changing a couple of other characteristics. And that's why they're an industry leader.
Right. But that's supposed to, if they would have waited for the radio to get to the field and then, you know, soldiers, the warfighter saying, hey, this thing jams this, it inadvertently pushes the button when we don't want it to, or it's hard to find the button. Those kinds of complaints come back, and then redesigning and recutting the molds and redoing it all, that's very, very expensive. Whereas you think that through from the start. Now, yeah, there are other tools out there that do this, but not as cleanly, I think. And it's the perspective. Now it makes sense why you call it this. It's how you're using the tool. The way you described it, I've seen it used in medical devices. They're doing a hazard analysis, and they have their top, the most likely events that have the highest consequence. The top of the FMEA is it would be another example. Then they have a policy that those require doing a fault tree analysis, and so that analysis then gives them enough detail to know to quantify exactly what that risk is. And so they then can look at, well, how do we improve it, or how do we eliminate or mitigate it? But it gives them a policy step to say, all right, this is something that we need a better understanding of, so we use fault tree to do that.
Right. And I certainly don't want to, I don't, hopefully you share this opinion of me, but I certainly don't want to force a tool on anyone. There are certain scenarios where a fault tree might not be appropriate, or a fault tree is appropriate, but it just doesn't gel with how you approach a problem. And there's nothing wrong with using any one of the raft of, not competing, but say complementary tools out there if that's going to work best with you and your team's thought process. But this course was, again, in response to a lot of feedback I received about, I didn't know fault trees could do that. Oh, that sounds cool. Can you tell me more? How long have you got?
Well, yeah. Usually you lose people when they open up the handbook and it says, all right, so here's an OR gate and an AND gate. And you can use NAND gates if you're really clever. And and it goes on and on and on. And then they have, there's just a bazillion logic gates to it. I think keeping that part simple and just organizing the thinking is really the first step. Now, for system reliability, you need a lot of information at those base events, those components or subsystems, in order to make that useful. And there's tools that help do the math in those cases. And please don't use just a point estimate.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because this course is also a little bit of a protest against existing tutorials and existing courses out there that, for whatever reason, always include NAND gates and NOR gates and all sorts of logic gates, which are derived from electronic system design and not reliability. And they're only in those courses because they're logic gates. And just for those listeners who are, who don't know what these logic gates are, it's just essentially if you have a redundant system, you need both components to fail for your system to fail. So you need one component and the second component to fail, which is why we have what we call this AND gate for logic. But a NAND gate means not AND, but I just see it in so many reliability engineering textbooks, which essentially means that your system will fail if none of your components have failed, one of your components have failed, but not both of them have failed. There's no scenario out there, but it's always in these courses for some reason.
Well, it's a nice graphic. You can fill up a whole page full of cool graphics and the formulas for them, but the in-application is like, all right, come on, let's actually use this in a meaningful way. I think that's the key. So anyway, there's three perspectives. That I learned something is a way to separate these things. And to be honest, I have seen all three, but I've always translated it or viewed it through the first one. This is really a system reliability thing. And if we don't put numbers in it, then it we can use it in failure analysis. We can use it in improvement opportunities. But I've always viewed it a different way. So that's helpful. So we'll see how it goes. All right. What I'm thinking is that that's the three perspectives. There's obviously more material on it. We've got to get you to do a webinar on it at some point and bring out a piece of this, what you're talking about, in more with all of your cool graphics and all that good stuff.
Well, and of course the course is coming to Ascendo as well. We'll sort out the launch details, but this workbook is from a larger course. Always interested to get feedback from Ascendo members on how that can be made better as well.
Yep. And when you mention that, I've been promoting, and I believe our first episode where this has been promoted, it's now available, is so I'm hoping to get some voice messages back as questions. So if you go to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, there's a comment field there that's been there for a long time, but now in the upper right hand corner, there's a little widget that says, push this button to record, and it'll give you 90 seconds to actually ask us a question, and we'll get an audio file, a voicemail essentially, and we could incorporate that, your voice, right on the podcast. And we'll respond to your question and try to make sure you get some information right off the bat. And then we'll, if it makes sense to as a good topic, which many of the questions we get do, then you'll become part of the conversation. And I think that's a cool new feature I'm looking forward to using. So if you got questions about fault trees or other reliability topics, or if you have a fourth perspective, a different way to use fault tree, it's absolutely not too late. We'll get Chris to get up to speed on that real quick, and we'll go from there. So look forward to hearing from you very literally with this new voicemail feature that we have at our comment field for SOR.
Yeah, that's super cool. It's always good to hear the voice of people. It just makes it that much more personal as well.
Yep. Definitely. All right. Well, thanks, Chris. And I'm on the tap to give you a review of this thing. I'll do more than spelling if I can.
That's right.
And we'll go from there. All right.
Cheers, Fred.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.